This is The Point on CAI. I'm Jeanette Barnes, in for Mindy Todd. It's Friday, September 5th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Amy Kolb-Noyes, Anastasia Lennon and Brooke Kushwaha of the New Bedford Light, Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, Haley Duffy of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Inquirer and Mirror on Nantucket, and CAI's Gilda Geist talks with State House correspondent Katie Lennon. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Another local offshore wind project could be in trouble. The Trump administration says in a court filing that it plans to revoke a key permit for New England Wind 1. This is the wind farm that would be directly southwest of Vineyard Wind off Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket. Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light is here with that story. Welcome, Anastasia.
Good morning, Jeanette. Thanks for having me.
So first, what is the permit the administration wants to take away, and why is it critical for New England Wind?
Yeah, so just to step back, these major wind projects, they go through lengthy, often years-long reviews, and they need permits from several agencies. So there's the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is the lead regulator, and they issue a lot of permits. And then you have NOAA Fisheries, the EPA, and Army Corps of Engineers, and so on. But the permit in question that the administration has stated it intends to revoke is the construction and operations plan, which is issued by BOEM. And this is essentially one of the final green lights that a project gets, that they can move forward with construction so that their plan to construct an ultimate plan to operate for the 20 or more years of operations is approved and that they can move forward. And so this project, New England Wind 1, it is fully permitted at the federal level. So this is rather significant. If they were to revoke this permit, then, this project could be now moved and stuck in limbo along with other projects that have some permits, but not all of them.
The Trump administration hasn't made a big announcement about this, it seems like, but they say in that court document they plan to vacate the permit by October 10th at the latest. Is this is kind of buried in a court case. Can you tell us how this came about?
Yep. So I actually learned about it through an announcement that a plaintiff in the case had shared. So there are groups that are opposing offshore wind development, and one of them, Act for Wales, it's a plaintiff. And so they shared a press release celebrating this news. And this filing was made as part of their case against the project, seeking that the administration stop these projects, that they revoke necessary permits, including this construction and operations plan. And this is actually part of a pattern we're seeing. It's linked to these pending lawsuits against projects that are playing, it seems, an increasingly important role. And why is that? Well, this administration, when Trump took office, they've issued many actions and secretarial orders about offshore wind development. And one of those, which was issued in July, directs the Department of Justice and counsel to review all pending litigation against offshore wind projects and determine any cases in which a remand or a revocation of permits is appropriate. And so that's what we're seeing with New England Wind, and we're also seeing it with South Coast Wind, which is another project planned south of Massachusetts.
You tried to get Avangrid, the owner of New England Wind 1, to talk about this. What did they have to say?
The common response I get from them lately, which is no comment. So they're taking a silent approach, as they have been and other developers have been since Trump took office, though we are seeing some fight back, including Ørsted, which just filed a lawsuit against the administration this week.
I know you did get a chance to talk to the mayor of New Bedford, John Mitchell. What is he saying about this?
So he says it's disappointing but not surprising. He says it will be an economic harm to New Bedford. The city has, he described it as, matching some investments that the state and developers have made. He does stress that the city has always set out to diversify its port, and so, while offshore wind maybe pauses for who knows how long, they'll still be able to support other industries. At the same time, he says these are job losses. It'll be a hit to local restaurants, hotels, businesses that have been supporting and very busy with workers that come in and that are working down at the terminal, which is owned by the state, but is, the center of the port of New Bedford. And so, he says it's definitely a loss for the city. And just to note, the city of New Bedford, South Coast Wind, for example, plans to use this major state terminal to build out its project in the same way Vineyard Wind is, but also other projects. New England Wind plan to use the sea for long-term operations of the project. So again, this is, 20 plus years of work. And while the operations phase of the project tends to require fewer workers, right, the big building out of the project is done, it's still ultimately jobs.
And I know you mentioned that the Trump administration has taken a lot of actions related to the permitting and the stop work orders and so forth. But another thing is the administration canceled $34 million in federal money for this to build the Salem Wind Terminal. And New England Wind 1 was going to use that terminal to stage construction, right? Because that's kind of the state really wants the wind developers to spread the wealth around in terms of places where they're engaging in economic development. So without that Salem Wind Terminal, do you know how that's going to affect New England Wind?
Yes, yeah, so I don't fully know. So, for example, a big question is this project, Salem Terminal, going to move forward without that $34 million in funding? So the terminal is a public-private partnership. So Crowley, the private partner, and this company, they said, they don't have any comment at this time. They're still figuring out what this means, and they'll keep you updated. The city of Salem, which is also involved in the project, says it's pursuing, considering legal options if there are. And so we don't really know what the future holds for this terminal. That being said, right, there is a terminal in New Bedford. And when I spoke with Mayor John Mitchell, he actually, he called it a bit of a silver lining amid all these actions against the offshore wind industry is that, with these setbacks to ports, including Salem, he makes a point that, New Bedford has a terminal that would be available and ready to support build out if these projects can move forward.
The New Bedford Lights, Anastasia Lennon, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Jeanette.
Next up, some news about the Cape Cod Bridges Replacement Project. CAI reported this story, and Amy Kolb-Noyes is joining us for a conversation about the bridges. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Jeanette.
I myself had the chance to talk this week with the head of the bridge project for the state. Her name is Louisa Piwanski, and she had two main pieces of news. One, there's a small change to the project. It's a lengthened bike path. It's only about a third of a mile extra, but it runs from Upper Cape Cod Regional Technical High School, where the path was originally going to end, east. It runs east to the Gallo Ice Arena. So the idea is that way high school students going to the arena, or really anyone, can have a safer space for walking or riding there. And Piwanski said that this is something that the town of Bourne requested and the state decided to go along with it.
Right. Yeah. But it adds millions of dollars to the cost, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. The state is estimating the bike path extension will cost between $5 and $6 million. But Piwanski said that changes are part of the budget in any project like this, especially a construction project of this size. The combined estimate for the bridges is $4.5 billion. So she says this is well within the contingency budget.
And there are some other elements to this change besides the bike path, right?
Yes, well, she didn't talk about that in depth, but there are some other things that are shown in the rendering of this bike path extension. It shows some median islands in the road there on Sandwich Road. It shows left turn lanes at the ice rink. But the second piece of news from the state on the bridge project this week is that the Massachusetts Department of Transportation has filed a required environmental report about the bridge project. This is called the Draft Environmental Impact Report. It's something that gets filed with the office administering the Massachusetts Environmental Policy Act. That's a lot of government names there, but essentially it's like an application for environmental approval. And filing one of these documents is considered a big step in any construction project. It shows how the bridges will affect everything around them environmentally. And that report's going to be available to the public next week. And then the state is accepting public comments on it because, again, this is the draft. So they take the comments before it's finalized. Comments can be made through October 24th.
And there's a federal version of this too, yes?
Yes, yes. So the state does have to file a comparable document at the federal level, again, about the environmental effects of the project. And they expect to do that within a month or so. But at the moment, they have to wait, actually, because the state cannot file that until it gets federal approval of something else, a different document, which is the state's assessment of how the bridge project will affect recreational resources. So that includes things like the campground at the Bourne Scenic Park, things like that.
Got it.
Okay, Amy, don't go too far, because later in this hour, we will have you back to talk about your reporting on how a citizen science project is being used locally to document coastal erosion.
Looking forward to it.
Wildfire is a real threat on Cape Cod. The subject of a regional meeting in Truro. It was the subject of a regional meeting in Truro in late August. I mean, it brought out officials from the county, state, and the Cape Cod National Seashore. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent is joining us with this story. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Jeanette.
So at this meeting, the superintendent of the seashore, Jennifer Flynn, said that Cape Cod has some time to plan for wildfire response, but it does need to approach the issue with some urgency. So tell us, where's that urgency coming from?
Well, there's a lot of accumulation of fuel on the ground and sort of even standing dead trees in Cape Cod. There's been fire suppression here for, you know, about a century or more, and when fire isn't a regular part of the landscape, dead material accumulates and makes the fire risk much higher.
Okay. Has the Cape done wildfire planning similar to this in the past?
The last wildfire plan is from 2012. There is an effort to update it. They're trying to sort of scrounge together the money, given that there won't be any federal money for that. There was some discussion about county money, some discussion about philanthropy and the Friends of the National Seashore. You have a lot of needs. They include maintaining the fire roads, doing brush clearing in the forest, and of course you have needs to be doing prescribed burns, which there's only been one of in about the last 5 or 6 years.
Okay, the seashore, as we know, is more than 43,000 acres. Some of that includes private property, of course, as well. What are some of the special fire considerations in a unique situation like this, with both the topography of the Cape and then also private land as part of it?
I think the proliferation of very small roads that are maintained in varying degrees, sometimes by varying actors. You might have the town, private landowners, and the seashore all with responsibilities for different stretches of a single road, you know, out in the woods. And putting large pieces of equipment down these really small roads during a fire can be dangerous in its own right. So it's not clear that the fire resources, the trucks and the engines, can go where they need to go if the roads themselves aren't maintained.
Are certain areas considered to be more at risk than others?
I mean, there are very large swathes of East Ham, Wellfleet, and Truro that are very thickly forested and also thickly settled with lots of small fire roads of varying degrees of maintenance. Provincetown is kind of different because the wildland and the town are very separate from each other, so you don't have nearly as much interface between the two. Although, of course, Provincetown is very densely packed wooden structures, so it's still, you know, the historic core of the town is vulnerable to fire.
I know the Independent reported that the Truro Fire Chief, Tim Collins, was encouraging people to request an at-home appointment with firefighters, and that would be to talk about ways to reduce the risk around their own homes. I understand that's free. What does that entail?
So defensible space is a concept that even getting very burnable stuff 20 to 30 feet away from your house makes a big difference. So, you know, where is your wood pile for your winter firewood? What's stored under your deck? If you have firewood stored under your deck adjacent to your house, that's a problem. They want you to move the firewood somewhere else. Sometimes it has to do with brush thinning. You might have these beautiful little line of scrub oaks, but maybe like cutting a break in that line so they don't run right up against the side of your house, that kind of a thing.
Okay. Fire is not always the enemy, though, right? I think you may have mentioned the controlled burns. What is the feeling right now about doing more controlled burns?
It's a really significant problem. There's only one fire crew member at the National Seashore right now, the assistant fire management officer. We used to have a fire management officer, but when that person retired, the job was reposted as being based out of Acadia National Park in Maine. And some of the work that he used to supervise which included a volunteer crew that was, and we're talking, you know, people who live here, just volunteering to gather up brush piles, gather up dead material, put it into brush piles, and burn those brush piles on safe days, you know, in the winter when humidity is really high and it's not hot. That work has come to a stop. So we don't have the volunteer efforts to gather up fuel and mitigate it that we used to have even only 4 years ago. The seashore is talking about getting that restarted, but with personnel really at a minimum right now, there's questions about whether that work can begin again or not.
It sounded like when you mentioned volunteers, it reminded me that officials in that meeting were kind of calling on the Friends of the National Seashore to do more, were they?
They were talking about raising money to help update the fire plan, yes, which the Friends of the Seashore can raise money for specific parks. But then you also have that call for volunteers. They used to be called the Woodchucks, and they would gather, you know, about 20, 30 people would gather on Tuesday mornings and do a lot of brush piling and burning. And that, I think, is work that's important as well, that the fire management officer at the time believed was important. And there's sort of a mix of hopes and questions about whether that work can begin again.
The National Seashore is part of the National Park Service, which has seen quite a few staffing cuts in the last year or so, and the Park Service could be facing more budget cuts next year. What is the situation with funding to work on the wildfire issue?
That was really interesting because Superintendent Jennifer Flynn explained that the park actually has to compete against other national parks out west with much more acreage, with a very different fire profile. You know, they're putting in funding requests to do 1,000-acre burns, right? While the National Seashore is putting in funding requests to do 1, 2, and 5-acre burns. So when you're looking at it from headquarters, the National Seashore's requests don't appear to be that competitive because they're on a much smaller scale because our geography is very different from what you're looking at in Yellowstone. So she sort of had this very interesting point that it can be hard for the seashore to secure the federal funds to support this work because the comparison to these much larger parks out west, it doesn't always compute.
Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, thank you for your reporting on that issue.
Thank you, Jeanette.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Jeanette Barnes. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Haley Duffy of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Jeanette Barnes, in for Mindy Todd. Federal mandates on offshore wind seem to make news almost every day this week, but in Chilmark, the town has wind news of its own. Haley Duffy of the Martha's Vineyard Times is here with that story, and also some news about an addition to Martha's Vineyard Regional High School. Hello, Haley.
Hi, Jeanette. How are you?
First, let's talk wind. Your story says the Chilmark Select Board is trying to open up a dialogue with other vineyard towns to see if they want to collaborate on some of the kinds of things that Nantucket has done related to vineyard wind. What are some of those things they're considering?
You know, they weren't very specific yet about what action they might want to take, but one Select Board member, Jeffrey Maida, was very clear that he thinks it's important that there's some money somewhere, that if there's another blade break, like the one that happened last summer, that cleanup costs would be covered and that it wouldn't be put on the towns to do that.
And you said that Chilmark is the first town on Martha's Vineyard taking this kind of public step. Why haven't the vineyard towns been more involved in this before?
You know, it's interesting. I think in my reporting on this, I've realized there's a lot of differences between Nantucket and the Vineyard. And one of those is that Nantucket is one town and the Vineyard is six, and they don't necessarily work together all of the time. The only other town on the island that has discussed vineyard wind is Edgartown, although they did so in an executive session. So we're not necessarily sure what actually happened in that meeting. But yes, this past week when Chilmark talked in a public meeting, it was the first time that there seemed to really be open dialogue and a motion made about doing something.
Has there been any response so far from the other towns?
Not yet. I spoke with Edgartown afterwards, and they said they would be open to collaborating with Chilmark. But I think we have to check in whether or not Chilmark actually sent out a letter yet. you know, it takes a little while to draft and then get it signed by all of the select board members. So I guess we'll see soon.
I know that at least some of the select board members in Chilmark are also interested in reviewing the community benefit agreement with Vineyard Wind. Mm-hmm. What is the issue there?
Yeah, so like Nantucket, the Vineyard has a community benefit agreement, but unlike Nantucket, which their community benefit agreement is with the town, ours is with a nonprofit called Vineyard Power, and so was not a public document until a couple weeks ago when both me and a few select board island officials asked to see it, and it was made public. And I think it's been a document that was not public for 10 years, although Vineyard Power, you know, talked about what was in it. And I think that they are now seeing what Nantucket is doing and wondering if they should get more. And it was interesting because this community benefit agreement is with Vineyard Wind. However, Chilmark Select Board members expressed interest in maybe getting agreements with other wind farms off the coast of the island.
Okay, let's shift now to the news about Martha's Vineyard Regional High School. The school district is looking to do both a renovation and an addition to the high school, and they've taken a significant step this week. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so they were voted by the State School Building Authority's Board of Directors to move into the schematic design phase, which means that now plans can be formalized and brought to the island community for further scrutiny, and then the state will eventually make a decision whether or not they'll financially support the project. But they need to keep having the building authority's approval, so this was like a great step in that direction. And they also need the approval in order to ensure a reimbursement rate of about 38% for the cost of the project, which happens to be the most costly project the island's ever seen.
Do you know what would be in the addition?
Yeah, the addition renovation plan is a 2-4 update. And then new facilities for career and technical education departments that are currently below state requirements. However, because it's an addition renovation plan, students wouldn't have to relocate as they do construction to an outsourced facility.
Haley Duffy of the Martha's Vineyard Times, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Jeanette.
Affordable housing is a big issue in our region. Many say more is sorely needed, perhaps nowhere more so than in Chatham. But the select board seems to be divided on some of the proposed developments. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here with that story and more. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
So there are two affordable housing projects before Chatham's Zoning Board of Appeals. One's on Meeting House Road, one's on Main Street. They're both being developed by the same company. And you reported that there's some disagreement becoming evident among select board members about these projects. Tell us about that.
Yeah, at a recent discussion at the select board, the question arose about whether the board should be providing input into the 40B hearings that, as you said, the zoning board is currently conducting on these two projects. And a new board member, Stuart Smith, feels that there's some concern in the community. He said he has concerns about the project, a lot of which center around density and the appearance of the proposed buildings. And he feels that the board should be giving input to the zoning board about these projects. The problem is that the town, the select board specifically, in negotiating with the developer, which is Penrose, who we know has developed a number of affordable projects in the region, their agreement with Penrose requires that the select board support the project. And town council told the board recently that any sort of input at this point from the board could run afoul of that clause in the land disposition agreement. He basically said that the board's opportunity to shape the project came when it was negotiating with Penrose over these two developments, and that now everything is in the hands of the Zoning Board of Appeals, which can hear from town boards, but the town council indicated that the select board sort of has to stand apart from these proceedings.
And one member of the select board, Stuart Smith, was asking the board to pass a motion urging the zoning board to consider concerns and impacts of the affordable housing. What happened with that motion the other night?
Well, the motion, because of concerns about the Board of Selectmen's, signing that agreement, Chairman of the Board, Dean DeCastro, he declined to even entertain that motion. He basically said he's concerned that should the board do that, they could be put the town and themselves in financial or in legal jeopardy for violating that agreement with Penrose. So there was no official motion, but Stuart Smith really made it clear that he thinks that the town needs to listen more to the community and take the concerns of residents into account in these projects. And town council said that those residents are invited to go to the Zoning Board of Appeals and provide their input. And members of the select board also as individual residents could do that. But he said the board as a whole taking any kind of position could run afoul of this section of the land disposition agreement they have with Penrose.
Okay, let's talk about a Harwich story. I feel like we should have like a job search website ad right here in the roundup, because Harwich has four major vacancies right now in top positions in town government. The latest one, I understand, is the assistant town administrator who is taking a different job in Yarmouth. Tim, tell us, what are the jobs that are open, and is there a common thread, a reason behind all of these departures at the similar time?
Sure. As you said, the current assistant town administrator actually just this week notified the town that she was taking the position of director of community development in Yarmouth. So that position is now open. The top position, the town administrator position, is open in Harwich. The previous town administrator, Joe Powers, left the job in June when his contract expired and the select board declined to renew it. Also, the finance director, town accountant position is open. So that's the town's top finance officer. And the assistant town accountant position is open. So these are like the four major top positions in the town that are now open. Harwich is currently, day-to-day administration is being run by an interim town administrator, Anthony Sciava, who has been around the area for a while. But he's the town had passed over Megan Eldridge to serve in that interim position. And I think that sort of triggered her to sort of look for another position, although she apparently had applied for the Yarmouth job previous to that. But I think, in answer to your question, this has been a problem in Harwich for about 4 or 5 years with people leaving top positions after only a short time. Many people in town, including some members of the board of selectmen or the select board, have tied this back to the previous town administrator, Joe Powers, who just wasn't able to keep these people in top positions. And that was obviously a subject of a lot of tension within the town. And with Powers now gone and a search on for a new town administrator, as well as these other positions, I think officials in Harwich are hoping that they can sort of stabilize the town administration, at least in the short term.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Now to Nantucket, where school enrollment has dropped after rising in the 2010s. Also on the island, a million-dollar donation to feed people who do not have enough fresh, healthy food on the island. Josh Balling of the Inquirer and Mirror is joining us now. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Okay, let's start with school enrollment on Nantucket. The K-12 school system has 54 fewer students this year than last year. It's a 3% drop, so not huge year over year. But why is this considered significant?
And it's a good question. I don't know that school officials are all that concerned about it, as you say, and I don't know whether they consider it significant or not, but what it does show, this is the first drop in enrollment that Nantucket Public Schools have seen in a number of years. There has been a steady increase in enrollment and in population on Nantucket as well over the last decade plus, and this is the first year that enrollment has dropped from the end of the previous school year to the start of the current school year. School officials are not exactly sure why. They offered no immediate thoughts as to why it might be down this year, but did say they were going to keep a close eye on it for budgeting and planning purposes. They did say that the incoming kindergarten class in particular is smaller than it has been in recent years, with only 91 students, and there's also a significantly smaller sixth grade class, Superintendent Beth Hallett told the school committee on Tuesday. So they're really looking at it sort of as more of a plateau after the steady increase for a number of years, an increase that was enough that about a decade ago they had to build a new intermediate school for students in grades 2 through 5 and separate it from the elementary school here because it was just not big enough for all the students that were coming into the school. Each grade is averaging about around 120 students, and Nantucket High School now has the most students with 567 in 9th through 12th grade.
So is there concern for the use of the new school or the school buildings if the student population doesn't stay at that elevated level?
I don't believe so, and they certainly haven't gotten there yet. Like you certainly pointed out, a 3% drop, 54 students across 12 grades, is not incredibly significant one way or the other, and it might mean in a positive way that class sizes might come down a little bit, and most educators will agree that smaller class sizes are generally a better idea than larger class sizes. It allows for more individual instruction, and the intermediate school is full. I don't think there's any danger of empty classrooms. There's more than enough activity going on in the schools, and the classrooms have been on the smaller side with all the influx. So I don't think there's any real worry right now that they built the school and now there's not going to be anybody to fill it anytime soon.
All right, let's talk about Nourish Nantucket. This is a food security initiative on the island. This summer, they rebranded themselves from the Nantucket Resource Partnership. That was the previous name. But now they're focusing more heavily on food. And I learned from your reporting that they have received a really substantial donation. Tell us about this.
They did. They're calling it a transformational gift, and it certainly sounds like it. It's a $1 million gift from a donor who they know who it is, but who has asked to remain anonymous to the public. And this donor was very clear about how they wanted the money spent. In their words, they wanted it used to, quote-unquote, get food in people's hands immediately. Nourish Nantucket Director of Development and Operations Meg Browers said this week, a recent study by the Greater Boston Food Bank revealed that nearly 1 in 3 year-round Nantucket families experiences some level of food insecurity. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's no food on the table, but as you mentioned in the intro, it means that they may not have the freshest, most healthy food they could get, or they may unfortunately have to skip a meal here or there or rely on, again, on the school system, as we just talked about, potentially to provide free and reduced-priced lunches and breakfasts for their children. And this donation will go directly to support getting that fresh, healthy food into the hands of hundreds of Nantucketers by helping more individuals and families off of wait lists for the current food programs that are already out there.
Are there specific projects and things that Nourish Nantucket plans to support with this money?
They're starting to look at that in terms of the specific projects right now, but they do have basically 8 partners on the island that they work with on food security issues, and they're going to begin by handing out the first installments of this gift to those organizations by the end of this week, so by today, and they expect to award multiple grants of $50,000 or more to the Nantucket Food Pantry, which is currently searching for a new home. We've talked about that before, to Pip and Anchor, which is a grocery store on the island that provides fresh island-grown produce weekly to those in need, Meals on Wheels, and a number of other groups are also going to be in among the first recipients of some of this grant money.
Josh Walling from The Inquirer and Mirror, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll take a look at some highlights from the State House this week. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Jeanette Barnes, in for Mindy Todd. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Now to news from the State House. The governor promises Massachusetts residents COVID vaccine access. The attorney general approves a record number of ballot proposals. And a judge rules in favor of the former Cannabis Control Commission chair. CAI's Gilda Geist talks with State House reporter Katie Lannon about the latest news from Beacon Hill. Here's their conversation.
This week, you were at a press conference where Governor Maura Healey discussed vaccine access in the state. And this comes just as Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is testifying before the Senate about COVID vaccine access. So what did Governor Healey have to say about vaccine access here in Massachusetts?
Essentially that she wants to preserve it, really, no matter what Kennedy and the federal government writ large should do, shall do going forward. On COVID shots in particular, she says that the state's public health commissioner has essentially written a prescription allowing Massachusetts residents to get those shots from pharmacies despite the new federal limits. And the state of Massachusetts is also requiring health insurers to cover all vaccines that are recommended by state public health officials, regardless of what the federal government might say. So that looks more broadly at things like the routine immunizations that school kids might need. They want to make sure cost isn't a barrier for anyone who wants a vaccine. Massachusetts, Healey says, will also be collaborating with other Northeastern and New England states on vaccine issues and broader public health infrastructure questions. So we'll see what emerges ultimately from that.
Also this week, Attorney General Andrea Campbell approved a record number of ballot questions that voters could be asked to weigh in on in upcoming elections. So there are way more proposals than we could ever fit into this segment. So can you just give us the highlight reel?
Yeah, for sure. All 40 of these questions won't ultimately make it onto the ballot. There's a lot of hurdles to go before next November. But many of them are election reforms, from same-day voting to voter ID requirements. There's some transparency measures that aim to open up records at the State House. And another one that's gotten a lot of attention so far would institute a statewide cap on annual rent hikes.
And finally, a judge ruled this week that former chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, Shannon O'Brien, was wrongfully terminated. So what happens next? Will she return to the commission?
That's still the big question. Shannon O'Brien says she plans to return as chair. The judge in this case has said she's entitled to serve out the remaining 2 years of her term and get back pay for the past year after she was fired. The new wrinkle is that State Treasurer Deb Goldberg, who fired O'Brien, is filing an appeal. So even though this process has been going on now for 2 years, we're still not fully at the end. The judge, when he gave out his order this week, suggested that he doesn't think Goldberg is likely to succeed in an appeal. He seemed to try to discourage her from filing one. But the treasurer says that the judge got it wrong and that the behavior she alleges that O'Brien partook in was harassment and bullying and shouldn't be tolerated. You know, O'Brien, meanwhile, says that she's glad to have her good name on the way to being restored.
That's CAI's Gilda Geist and State House reporter Katie Lannon. A story now about citizen science. Members of the public are using technology to help document coastal erosion. CAI's Amy Kolb-Noyes covered that story, and she is joining us now. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Jeanette.
So this project is called Coast Snap. I imagine the snap in that name has to do with photography because they're documenting coastal changes over time. But tell us how it works.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Coast Snap stations are heavy duty posts with phone cradles on them, and they're aimed towards the shoreline. So you can walk up, put your phone in the cradle, and snap a picture of the beach. And then you scan a QR code and upload the picture to a website. It's mycoast.org/MA. And that's where the photos are stored. And they're also compiled into time-lapse videos.
And scientists are using those videos to study the coastal changes. Is that right?
That's right. But they're also public, so anyone interested can check out the photos. And if you go there often, over time, you can see how a shoreline erodes and recovers through storms and king tides and more common events like beach grooming. And then, as I said, they are put together into time-lapse videos periodically.
Who's running this project?
Well, the original project started in Sydney, Australia in 2017, and it's since spread around the world. But the efforts are all coordinated locally. So in Massachusetts, it's run by Huey C. Grant. And Brian McCormick coordinates the project here. He says he relies heavily on the cooperation of local municipalities. He says it really helps to have a local champion for the project to help usher it through the system.
Okay, so where are the locations here in Massachusetts where people can snap those pictures?
Well, there are two at Town Neck Beach in Sandwich. One faces east and the other faces west. And there's one on the Vineyard at State Beach in Oak Bluffs. And one at the end of Hummock Pond Road on Nantucket. And then last month, two new co-snaps were installed, one at Linnell Landing in Brewster and the other at Mariners Memorial Way in New Bedford.
And your story did focus on that New Bedford location of Coast Snap. What was special about that one?
The New Bedford Conservation Commission and its conservation agents, Chance Perks, really ran with the project there. Perks got students at the Votech High School involved in building the camera cradle. Excuse me. And then he talked a local business into working with them, and they fabricated a custom post to conform to the city's standard of appearance. So that one looks a little different than the other ones around the region. And now he's spreading the word to get other community groups involved with that citizen science goal.
Are there other new locations in the works?
Yes. McCormick said he's going to get, he's working on getting a co-snap installed on the North Shore in Scituate. And he's also open to working with other communities. So especially if they're as involved and supportive as the folks in New Bedford. So he's putting the word out there for people to contact them if they're interested.
Amy Kolb-Noyes, thank you so much for your reporting.
My pleasure.
We have one more story this morning to New Bedford, where a property owner was recently sent to jail for not complying with a fire protection order. The city and the property owner have been involved in a dispute for several years over fire protection at that property. But this latest news, a judge ordering him to jail, it comes in the wake of a Fall River fire at an assisted living facility this summer. That fire killed 10 people. Brooke Kushwaha of the New Bedford Light has the story about fire enforcement in New Bedford. Hi, Brooke.
Hi.
You reported on this action against two property owners who've been held in contempt for failing to comply with court-ordered fire safety watches. Only one of them went to jail. Tell us, what kinds of properties are these and what are the conditions there?
Yeah, so what's interesting about these properties, they're both in New Bedford's North End, historically Portuguese neighborhood that has undergone a lot of change. Both of these facilities are former industrial sites. So the first set of buildings is the site of a former munitions factory, and the second is on the coast, and it's the Star Plating South Plant location. So large, old facilities with industrial roots that have since fallen into disrepair.
And let's talk a little bit about the one case where the owner actually went to jail for 3 days. What are the circumstances that led to that?
So this is the latest in a long line of fire safety code violations that this property owner has received since 2022. The fire department has written up the building for non-functioning fire alarm systems, missing fire alarm and sprinkler tests. In fact, the fire department responded to these properties 14 times in 2022 and 2023 before eventually ordering the property owner to keep a 24/7 fire safety watch.
The city of New Bedford says it's cracking down generally on public safety risks in various neighborhoods. Is there anything else you can share about that?
Yeah, so you mentioned the Fall River fire this past July, but in 2023, New Bedford had its own very deadly rooming house fire that prompted a wave of various reforms and enforcement mechanisms. Namely, New Bedford created the position of a high-risk building inspector tasked with monitoring properties with higher occupancy, with a history of fire response calls or fire safety violations. And they focus on rooming houses because of their high occupancy, many of which are in the North End. And they just started going down the list and cracking down, essentially, and this is part of that wave.
And there was some kind of new inspector position created after that rooming house fire, right? What is that person doing?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, this is it's one position, so only one inspector for thousands of properties. But essentially, they log and inspect properties that they deem to be high risk, whether that's because the threshold is four families or more is considered a high occupancy, which is a broad swath of buildings in New Bedford. Also, they highlight buildings with histories of fires, repeat offenders, so to speak, and they just ramp up enforcement. They go through about 200 inspections per quarter or 800 inspections per year of these approximately 4,000 buildings qualify as high risk in New Bedford.
I know the buildings in these cases this week are supposed to have a fire safety watch, like the actual person watching all the time. What is involved in that?
So it kind of is what it sounds like. They, at the expense of the property owner, they need to have a person keeping watch on the building, on the premises of the building, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to ensure that a fire doesn't take place or to take action immediately if one were to occur. Both of the buildings, both the property owners in these two cases failed to keep someone on the premises after the city ordered them to.
I know you reported that at least one of these properties has two firefighters from the New Bedford Fire Department there around the clock, right? I mean, is that something that the department has enough staff to do?
You know, I can't speak to that directly. You would have to ask the fire department, but from everything I've heard about just how they're staffing is going in general, no, it's not the most efficient use of resources. We have that in a complaint in the city that even just responding to the frequent fires at these facilities before they had a fire safety watch was not the best use of the department's resources. And all of that is coming out of the property owner's expense, the payment for those two firefighters.
Okay. And so what's next for these properties involved in the cases this week?
Basically, the property owners will have to comply with the court and eventually remedy the fire safety violations that they've been ignoring for years.
Okay. Are there other things the city is doing kind of not necessarily in response to the Fall River fire, but with the knowledge that that occurred and that fire in high occupancy buildings is a risk?
So they just brought in a new chief in July, Brian Medeiros, who is working on a new system to track and monitor these high-risk buildings, but also just all of the higher occupancy buildings in New Bedford. It's very early days, but we will have more reporting on that soon.
Okay. Brooke Kushwaha of the New Bedford Light, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests, CAI's Amy Kolb-Noyes, Anastasia Lennon, and Brooke Kushwaha of the New Bedford Light, Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, Haley Duffy of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Inquirer and Mirror on Nantucket, and CAI's Gilda Geist, talking with State House correspondent Katie Lennon. And thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. In Woods Hole, I'm Jeanette Barnes. Thank you for listening.